play the good game.
What happened?
See what happened with the rain.
Hi, everyone. It's a great pleasure to welcome you all. My name is Susie Hall, and I am based in the Sociology Department at LSE. It's a great pleasure to welcome Blair Sackett and to extend my thanks to Annette Leroux, who's been such a generous participant in our department over the past few months. Annette Leroux is a professor of sociology at the University of Pennsylvania, but she's also been the Levi Hume visiting professor at the LSE, which is a very special role, and you have fulfilled it with a huge care for early career scholars and for people within the department, and I have had great feedback about the gifts that you've given, so thank you. She is, aside from being a generous colleague, an amazing author of award-winning books like Unequal Childhoods, Home Advantage, and Listening to People. Dr. Blair Sackett is a postdoc fellow at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University, and her research examines the intersections of social inequality and forced migration. But you're also a committed ethnographer who invests a huge amount of time in difficult territories, camps in Kenya, homes of people who are cast out of the system in the US. And you can really tell in this fantastic book, We Thought It Would Be Heaven, the necessary perspectives of the ethnographic view. I think that what is so distinctive about this essential book is that it reveals, I think for the first time in the form that I've seen it in this book, the impenetrable institutional thicket, which you conceptualize as hurdles, knots, and reverberations, and the implications that these have for refugee lives. This thicket is about more red tape that is profoundly dense. It's about the multiplication of procedures. It's about the invariable extension of regulations that end up actually profoundly jamming refugee life and prospect. For the refugee families that are at the heart of this book, they begin life in the US with their hands tied behind their back. So they arrive with already a substantial debt to the state because they've got to pay back the journey to the state, but they're also expected to stand on their own two feet within 90 days of arriving in the US, despite the fact that they have spent decades of their lives in refugee camps and decades of their life contending with profoundly heinous and violent war in the DRC. For me, part of the delicacy and nuance of this extraordinary book is precisely its duration, but also, really importantly, the extended follow-up. So spending time with families and then coming back after an interval to understand the occurrence of this echo, the institutional density. So thank you both so much for sharing your book with us, and I welcome and look forward to a rich discussion. Blair and Annette are going to speak for about 45 minutes, and then we'll open it up for Q&A. Thank you very much. Over to you.
Thank you for that very warm and generous introduction. We're honored to be here. Let me begin by thanking the Leverhulme Trust, who provided the resources for my visit, in the UK, for Mike Savage and Sam Friedman, for sponsoring me, Liz Mann, who did an enormous amount of work, and Laura Wayne, and of course to Susie Hall for graciously agreeing to chair this event and for this very generous introduction. We're very happy to be here. Blair and I will be tag teaming today, and she actually did all the data collection for the research, as we'll explain in a minute. But we wanted to begin by setting the theoretical context. So, as many of you know, Bourdieu talks about the concept of field, and which we use the notion of institutional arrangements and dominant institutions, which determine the rules of the game. You know, a field can be thought of course, as a hierarchical set of power relationships, And most importantly, the rules of the game determine what counts and what doesn't count in terms of forms of cultural knowledge and which can lead to then profit. And in a society which deeply values meritocracy and individual achievement, these structural arrangements are often hidden from view. And many people focus on the intrinsic value of certain forms of cultural knowledge, reading to kids and so forth, rather than looking at the compliance with the rules of the game. So we're going to share today the results of this ethnographic study in Philadelphia and show, of course, our refugees had extensive forms of cultural knowledge and expertise, including managing to live with very scant resources in refugee camps, speaking multiple languages, surviving trauma in the DRC, but these were not valued in the Philadelphia context. And in addition, Borgia wrote in the context of France. And the US is a very different institutional context than France. Among other things, the US has a decentralized structure with 50 states, California, New York, et cetera. And rather than, for example, having a universal healthcare system, such as the NHS, each state, the governor can decide in the legislature whether or not to accept federal dollars for Medicaid reimbursement. So it's an extremely complicated patchwork of different systems in every single field. So in healthcare and housing and unemployment and education, people who move across state lines typically lose benefits. And so the family is really the nexus for dealing with this host of different fields. And research has shown, administrative burden research in particular, that managing the many different rules can be cumbersome and people can be very demanding for time and knowledge and emotional bandwidth, particularly for families of color. Leslie Paik, in her excellent and award-winning book, Trapped in a Maze, shows how families get trapped in this system and matters of social control. And organizational sociologists suggest that complexity increases error. And we have to see error as baked into the system. It's not that organizations go smoothly. And so error is predictably unpredictable. But less attention has been given to the nature of these institutional obstacles, and particularly, as we'll show, across different institutions. And so, studies have, one of the things we want to bring attention to is all the different institutions the families deal with. Here's a picture that shows some of them, including bank frauds, which many of our refugees experienced, and interactions with child protective services, which we'll show is very common, especially for African-American families in the US. And the reality is that families have to navigate all of these institutions all at the same time, and refugees arrive and instantly they have to set up organizational processes everywhere all at once. And so, of course, we have a robust and valuable literature in migration studies, and those studies have pointed to immigrant incorporation and the context of reception. And so we've learned a great deal from these different studies. We just have a few of them up there. But on the one hand, institutions are theorized to play a key role and offer valuable resources, and they can present barriers, especially for people who lack legal status, for example. But again, the issue is that there are so many processes, people have often looked either at home ownership or college graduation, but not across different spheres. So to preview our argument, in our book, we show that the very social service organizations meant to help refugees halt their access to critical resources by erecting a bewildering array of obstacles. And so as newly arrived families start their lives, they navigate not simply schools and workplaces where the caseworker helps them and they have legal status, unlike undocumented people, but also banks, housing agencies, welfare offices. Each of these present a hurdle, and a hurdle is a routine rule or requirement for accessing services. But with so many processes and demands, There's a lot that could go wrong, and there are these errors and mishaps that tangle institutional procedures, forming knots or complex blockages. So we talk about hurdles and knots, which we're going to talk about today, but often families get navigate all institutions at once, and these are interconnected but not coordinated, and it was not uncommon that one problem reverberated across and impacted created a new problem in yet another institution. And most importantly, this blocks access to resources and can thus impede upward mobility. So let me switch over to Blair. Oh, sorry, I forgot. But there are factors that help, and the cultural brokers and institutional insiders can make a huge difference, especially faith-based groups that help one refugee family, as we'll explain. And they can overcome obstacles, they can untie knots, they can boost progress of upward mobility for certain families. Okay, there we go.
So a little more context, we're looking here at the case of resettled refugees to the US, specifically Congolese. And so just really briefly, this is a really rare pathway. It's a very unique migration pathway with a very specific set of institutional processes. Less than 1% of refugees globally receive resettlement. So this is a very rare, and in many ways, these families were seen as kind of the lucky few. Although as we show, they still face significant barriers. Upon receiving resettlement, it's a very specific pathway, sort of as Susie mentioned. Refugees who are resettled are selected by the United Nations and different countries around the world, governments. And so these families who have been selected then receive assistance where these organizations coordinate their travel, they pay the airfare up front, although that's a loan that refugees then have to repay. And crucially, in the United States, when refugees arrive, they receive assistance through the Federal Refugee Resettlement Program. So scholars in general and immigration studies have theorized that refugees have a particularly favorable pathway to the US. They have all of this support. When they arrive, they have 90 days of assistance from a caseworker who meets them at the airport, speaks their language or is able to get a translator, takes them to enroll their children at school, brings them to doctor's appointments, and sort of sets up the day-to-day life. Additionally, they're eligible for the very limited but essential U.S. social safety net. So not all immigrants receive that in the U.S., but refugees are able to access those services. However, this program is set up with a sort of ideology that refugees be self-sufficient within 90 days. This is like 3 months, really fast. Previously, in past decades, this period of time used to be closer to 3 years. So this is a very truncated period. Here we're focusing specifically on refugee families who have come from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Since 2016, Congolese refugees are the largest nationality group being resettled to the US. It's often kind of an unknown fact. Many of these families, however, first fled to refugee camps in neighboring countries around the Democratic Republic of the Congo, living there for decades before being selected for resettlement. So we did research with Congolese families who had been resettled to the Philadelphia area. I first met the Congolese families we did ethnographic observations with through an English as a second language class. All of the refugees, when they arrived, were mandated through their organizations to attend these classes, although attendance often fell off once they received a job and there were scheduling conflicts. But I attended the classes and got to know the Congolese families there. So over time, we built relationships, and then I asked them, you know, would you mind if we did observations beyond the class? Can I come with you to your house, follow you through your day-to-day life, go to the grocery store, observe as you meet with caseworkers, or go to these different institutional settings? All of the families agreed, and we spent over anywhere from 9 to 18 months, some of the families moved, spending time together, visiting together every week. Additionally, about 5 years, the observations were very close to when the families first arrived. And about 5 years after they arrived, I did follow-up interviews to see how were the families doing now. So it gave a little bit of a longitudinal view of how things had gone. Additionally, the smaller subset of observations were supplemented with a larger set of in-depth interviews with 40 other Congolese refugee families. These families were from across the US. We did them some in person, but also some on the phone or on Zoom. Some of these happened during the pandemic. I worked together with a team of Kenyan undergrad research assistants, which also gave us a really interesting view into how our different positionalities as researchers mattered, and gave us an opportunity to compare what people told me versus the Kenyan research assistants. One thing we thought would be a difference were on reports of racial discrimination. But interestingly, there was not a lot of difference there. There were more differences in reporting around things like corporal punishment of children and some views on marriage, as well as some more critical views of life in the US, such as like what women wore or things like that. They were less likely to tell me. But this was sort of working with this diverse team gave us a really interesting view on that process. Additionally, we did interviews with aid workers and volunteers who had worked with families to kind of capture that institutional perspective and get their views as well. We followed standard processes in data analysis. And so kind of in the book, we feature four of the families really delving in depth into their experiences. But drawing upon the larger interview sample to make our conclusions. So as Annette introduced, we found that while refugees, the people we got to know, were sort of seen as the lucky few and did have access to extremely crucial supports that they were eligible for, they faced a lot of hurdles in terms of actually accessing those resources. So the families we talked to faced what we call hurdles, which were routine rules and requirements. These could be very small things, seemingly small things like filling out a form for a summer school educational program. But for newcomers who might not know the language, who might not be used to our types of forms and bureaucracy, these little things could become big things, creating a barrier, a hurdle, blocking access to valuable resources, whether that be a summer school program or food assistance. And these hurdles were across all kinds of institutions. Of course, these were not things that were just neutral rules. Other scholars have shown that these kinds of rules and regulations, this sort of need to protect or root out the fraudulent applicant, are deeply rooted in larger structures of inequality in the US by race, class, and gender. And furthermore, these hurdles created a lot of opportunity for things to go wrong. So there were many, many pitfalls. So Malu and Mariamu Muhammad came to the United States with their 8 children, and they had high hopes for a better life. They had lived in a refugee camp in Tanzania for about 15 or 16 years. And after life in the camp, they were really excited that maybe in the US they were going to find a better life for them and their 8 children. Once they arrived, Mari got a job in a vegetable factory making just over minimum wage, and Malu stayed home with the children. He had a disability and was his right leg was amputated from the hip down. So he could often be found at home during the day on the couch with his crutches next to him, listening to Swahili news on his smartphone. He took care of the family's 18-month-old twins and 4-year-old daughter, Sibi, while the older children were at school. So crucially, through Mari's job at the vegetable factory, the family was eligible for an early Head Start program, which is sort of like a preschool level program intended to provide access to early childhood education for low-income families. However, nobody told the family that they were eligible. Nobody told the family that this was a benefit through Mari's work. So when the family arrived in the heat of July, nobody told them. All through the fall, the whole first semester, they had no idea. It wasn't until January that a caseworker came to their house, a full semester of educational opportunity lost, to enroll her in the program. So when I arrived at the family's house, Nevin, an Indian American caseworker, had come to the house and was working with Malu to try to figure out all of the necessary forms. Nevin was sitting on the couch and explained that he needed, he says, "I have to fill out this form, but I need him, Malu, to find me and give me mail address to him with his current address to verify his residency. He gave me this," he holds up electricity bill, "but it's in somebody else's name," right? It had to be the right kind of documentation with the right person's name and the right address, and everything had to be perfectly aligned, which takes cultural knowledge, right? Couldn't be any form, it couldn't say any name, it couldn't have any address, it had to be the exact one, and they had to know what form was needed. So Nevin sends Malu back upstairs on his crutches, making his way up, and he brings down another form, holding it in his hand. Nevin looks at it again. "Oh, this won't work. It has to be an official document. This time it's an advertisement that you kind of like get in the mail, junk mail, right?" And so he says, "This won't work," right? So Nevin goes back upstairs looking for forms again. Eventually, he comes back down and finds a bank statement with his wife's name on it, which is deemed sufficient. And so Nevin proceeds with the paperwork. This one hurdle was crossed, but this was just one of many just to enroll for this one service. So Nevin explained, not only was this proof of residency needed, but also an extensive stack of documentation, vaccination records, medical records, proof of residency, dental records, all to enroll Sibi for this program that she was eligible for. These were all across different organizations or institutional fields, and each field had its own rules, and so each form took specific knowledge to gain. Nevin concluded when he explained, it can take the organizations a really long time. Sometimes it might take them a whole month, right? And so what we saw was that Sibi had missed this whole semester of educational opportunity while these organizations bounced back and forth looking for this paperwork. This delay in enrollment had consequences beyond just the immediate education loss. So as Nevin filled out the paper, he was looking down at the forms and he announced in a matter-of-fact tone to Malu. So unfortunately, the earliest Head Start program, which is right down the street, is already full. So the closest opening was nearly a mile from their house, from their apartment. This was down bumpy Philadelphia sidewalks, all uneven and with lots of holes and gaps and across a busy like highway street. And so given Malu's limited mobility, this delay and the sort of lack of opening in the nearby program was a huge problem. Malu was unable to get Stivi, the four-year-old, but also their 18-month-old twins to that program every morning and back. So for them, this distance was a deal breaker. Malu took a breath, thought about it, and reapplied assertively. We want Sivi to go to school and we want her to start now, but I don't think I can make it there. So then Nevin says, oh, well, that's the only opening, I don't know. And Malu says, well, can you at least come tomorrow and show me where it is? And he's like, oh, I don't know, I'm kind of busy, you know, maybe we'll see. And then he says, he has me translate that essentially if this spot is not taken, it will be until the next school year when the openings are reopened that they could try to get a spot in the closer location. The next day, Sivi doesn't go to school, Nevin doesn't come back, and the family misses out on this educational opportunity. With so many hurdles and complexity across every institution, there was a lot that could go wrong. This complexity created a situation in which there was a lot of potential for errors, for missteps, for accidents. And when one little kind of error, seemingly small thing, a misspelled name on a form, a missed form, maybe a missed appointment, these could tangle procedures, creating a complex knot that blocked services and required an additional amount of cultural sort of capital, cultural knowledge, institutional know-how to untie. They were costly and stressful for the families, and they often threatened access to these key resources. So Honoria Kiminuera and her family arrived to the US like Malu and Mari, hoping for a better life for their children, her children. Honoria was a single mother during the Second Congo War. She had been at a church service at sunrise, and the service was stopped because gunshots erupted in the area. She returned home looking for her husband and children, but couldn't find them. Fighting had come to her town, the gunshots were getting closer, so she had to flee. Once she crossed the border to Uganda and found her way to a refugee camp, she received news that the rest of her family had been killed in the fighting. Honoria had great perseverance. She started a new family. She was remarried and had five more children. her husband was on a separate resettlement case, so they weren't resettled together. So she came to the US as a single mother with her five children. She was welcomed by a caseworker, Zeus, who helped her set up her day-to-day life. But after 16 years in a refugee camp, all of this time protecting her children, making sure they survived, making sure they got enough to eat, she ran into a problem in the U.S. with Child Protective Services. This is a child welfare agency. And so one little error and mishap tangled and threatened to have her children taken away. One day in January, in the cold, frigid day of January, Honoria, with no child care, left her children at home while she went to the grocery store to buy food. Her oldest child Peter is 12 years old, and she deemed him old enough to watch the younger children. In the refugee camp, the institutional rules and expectations were different. It was very common for children to be watched by older siblings and for any adult in the area to watch after them. In the US, she found different institutional rules and expectations. It's mandated that an adult or guardian supervising the children be at least 18 years old, right? So 12 years old was not old enough. While Honoria was gone, Daoudi, her two-year-old son, a rambunctious little boy, got out of the house. He was running around on the streets with no coat on, and somebody called the police. So when the police came, they took him back to the apartment and found that there was no adult there. Moreover, to scrimp to save money, Honoria hadn't turned the heat on. And so in the cold January, they found the house cold. Instead, she liked to layer on coats and try to save money. This was another hurdle that the family had not crossed. So between that, the police took her children to put them into Child Protective Services. When Honoria arrived to the apartment later, she found the apartment was empty. She didn't know where they were gone. Later that evening, police came back to the apartment, and however, they spoke English, and she could only speak Swahili. She speaks like four different languages, but not English. And so they gave her a stack of papers to sign. Not knowing what to do or what she was being asked to do, she went along with it and signed, confused about what was going on. Fortunately, she called her caseworker, Zeus, who rushed to the house. But by the time he got there, she'd already signed the forms, which were signing her children to the Child Protective Services. Zeus was crucial in helping her untie this knot. However, it was too late and the children were taken. Crucially, in the US, these kinds of investigations are deeply racialized and disproportionately fall on families. It's a burden that disproportionately falls on Black families in the US. Honoria was despondent. After all of these years taking care of her children, having them with her, hoping for a better life in the US, here they were taken away from her. She said, "You grow children in your stomach. Children need their mother. All the time in Africa, the children were always with me. I should have never left the refugee camp." So about 2 weeks later, Zeus helped her untie the knot and her children were back with her. But the stress and the problem didn't end there, right? This was stressful and time consuming. And deeply traumatic. In fact, when I interviewed the children 5 years later, they remembered being separated from their mother and the trauma of that. In fact, this problem created a reverberation. So a reverberation is when one institutional problem in one institution spreads across and creates new problems in different institutions. So because families are navigating many institutions all at once, these problems could reverberate, becoming new, bigger problems. For Honoria, for instance, the run-in with Child Protective Services created new problems with immigration. Refugees are eligible for a green card or permanent residency in the US after a year, but they have to apply. And she worried, she said, "How will I get it? They said, if you have a police case, you cannot get a green card," right? So she worried about how this case would affect her immigration status. Additionally, trouble with family courts, like the kind of run-in that Honoria had, can destabilize families' housing situations in the US. Scholars like Matt Desmond have shown it can lead to eviction. And indeed, Honoria's caseworker reported that about a few months after this instance, her landlord started contacting the caseworker saying, "I want her out, I'm kicking her out." The caseworker, Formally, the landlord took issue with the upkeep of the apartment, saying that he was kicking her out because of the smell of her food. But the caseworker was certain that it was about the CPS case, and she knew he knew about it as well. So these problems could spread, creating new problems in unrelated institutions.
So we want to tell you about another family here, the Nagoma family, and they arrived in the U.S. With their five children, who they had had over 19 years. Other children had died, and infants had died in the refugee camp. And they were relatively well-educated people, and Joseph was being targeted in the very brutal Civil War. So they were unusual in the sense that in addition to their caseworker, they also had faith-based volunteers across multiple churches and synagogues who acted as cultural brokers. They had very valuable cultural knowledge, and they had institutional know-how. They had volunteers. One person was doing tutoring, one person was driving the soccer, one person was handling the teaching them how to do a password on the banking. So they were a decentralized system. These are very common. I belong to Episcopal Church. We had a refugee family. So many churches have been active in these actions. Okay. And so Joseph and Georgette were both working for a while, but then they received food, what the people call it, the formula is called SNAP, but people often refer to it as food stamps. And the U.S. is very focused on deservedness. Do people, they're worried about fraud. And so every 6 months, people who receive food support, what we're gonna call food stamps, have to demonstrate that they still deserve to get the food stamps. So they have to fill out a recertification form, which is supposed to arrive at their house regularly. But, and here the upper middle class volunteers who were mostly white, but they were also Kenyan volunteers, and they were shocked by the complicated rules and regulations, and they had to learn what you can spend food stamps on and you can't, cleaning supplies are out, and so forth. And so for the recertification, you have to get pay slips, and Kathy, one of the volunteers, would work with Joseph and Georgette. And so Joseph would save all of the mail, all the flyers, everything, because he spoke Swahili, but not, you know, their languages, and he would just hand it to him. It was supposed to be a big manila envelope. Well, one time they said it just didn't appear. The form didn't appear, and Joseph and Georgette did not know that it was supposed to appear, and they did not know that they had missed it. And so they were cut off. And so then Kathy said, okay, we can appeal it. And so Kathy said, I filled out the appeal and mailed it in, and then I got a notice for the hearing, and then she went to Georgette because she spoke English and did the hearing, and the judge, I explained they never got the form. And it could have been stolen. She didn't know why, they just didn't get it. And the judge said, fine. But then what happened, we had a cultural broker who was extremely knowledgeable. But then when she was working with an employee trying to be helpful said, you don't have to populate, the machine will populate the form. You don't have to fill in the birthdays. But he was wrong. You had to write the birthdays because the form, they had been cut off. So in the end, Kathy winced. It took two months. It was right at the time when they were trying to recover from Georgette not having work because she had a health problem. So it was really bad. It meant that they ended up putting more stuff on the credit card and depleting their savings. The Nagomas lost food assistance for 2 months, which was worth $1,400. And Joseph's income was $2,400 for a family of six. So it was a very costly loss. So Kathy was fluent in English. She was very knowledgeable in American bureaucracy, but she could not forestall this knot. The system had too many opportunities for errors. And so then there were also institutional insiders, people who were just in the course of just doing their job, were extremely helpful in providing opportunities for upward mobility. They could prevent the obstacles, they could overcome obstacles. Now, to be sure, in some instances, they could act in a discriminatory and negative way, especially to certain populations, but in crucial moments, they provided assistance. So this is another one of our families. Elaine had worked as a government bureaucrat. Vanna had worked as a teacher. They had a Romeo and Juliet inter-ethnic marriage, and there were roadblocks being set up in the refugee camp, and so they fled. And they lived in Burundi for 16 years. They had very high hopes when they came to the U.S. Elaine discovered everything costs money. Everything's about money. And so Vanna got a job in a meat packing factory, a cutting cows for 42 hours a week at $13 an hour. You know, she was in a freezer room and her hands would swell with a hook in one hand and a knife in another. She would make small cuts, separating the lean meat from the excess fat. Elaine got a job in a slicing machine, a bread factory. He made $10 an hour. And family was incredibly frugal. They saved money like crazy. And although they had a very large family with their eight children, they were able to save money towards buying a home. And they attended a home buying course, which should have given them detailed information. But 2 years after the family arrived, they were trying to buy a home. Unlike the other family, they did not have cultural brokers. They had a friendly relationship with their caseworker who was no longer helping them, but sometimes they could call. And so they were completely dependent on the agents in these institutions. Because the Congolese was a relatively recent there wasn't like an elaborate ethnic enclave like there are in other parts of the US. And so, they scheduled an appointment, they filled out the application, it was rejected. We were told that a new person can't buy a house, you need to have a tax returns for 3 years consecutively, they had only been in the country 2 years. And so they just didn't have sufficient tax returns. They had gone through an entire extensive training for new home buyers in Philadelphia, but no one told them this one crucial piece of information. So they talked with a bank official to no avail. The bank was firm, but the bank official did give them detailed information that helped them about what they could do and how they could open up a credit card and how they could proceed in their quest to buy a home. So then, I'm in trouble here with this thing here. I'm sorry. So then they applied again. And then he discovered that his credit score wasn't good. I had some parking tickets. Where they had come from, you really didn't need to pay parking tickets. It just wasn't part of the institutional system. And so he hadn't paid them. And he said, I had several mistakes. The banker told me, you do not have a clean record. Get your wife a credit card. Since she has a clean record, make sure you pay your credit card on time. Always pay on time or advance at least 3 days. So this person, institutional insider, was giving them very helpful information to guide through this process. But they were heartbroken. They had the economic resources to buy a home, but they could not navigate the institutions. So in their third attempt, they met with the bank official who had helped them, who had been part of the home program, and they made an appointment with an official, and they were pre-approved for $200,000. And as they said, they jumped around for pure happiness. So, but here, institutional, and other people reported how teachers would tutor them, tell them about the SAT program, help them. Many first-generation college students have interviewed, said a teacher had helped them. So institutional insiders often actually fostered upward mobility. Sometimes they blocked it, but sometimes they fostered it. All right, so in our talk today, we have talked about the institutional mechanisms which help to sustain inequality. Gorgio has reminded us about the importance of the rules of the game. And so here we're saying we don't want to just look at outcomes or mile markers. Have you bought a home? Did your child go to college? But we need to look more at the mechanisms and the processes. And we see that there are numerous institutional obstacles. And we feel that scholars have underestimated these obstacles, and they've overlooked the burdens and barriers that families face. And we show that there are multiple institutions in a web of intersecting institutions, and the nature of the obstacles are rooted in this structure. Of course, there's a very challenging methodological issue of studying families and how they get help from cultural brokers and rules of the game, and then manage multiple institutions all at the same time. In sociology, many people are specialized in education or healthcare or housing or other fields. Although it's theoretically challenging, the tools are very valuable and they help us point away from an individual explanation of meritocracy. Also, Bourdieu's work on field, which grew out of the French context, it's a very different context in the US, and it's helpful to think more deeply about these 50 different systems in the US, and which all have very different rules. And so there's a way in which the US system is analytically different than the French system that Bourdieu wrote about. So the complexity then matters both empirically and it matters theoretically. It matters, for example, people often look at family school relationships, which are really families and schools, but this overlooks the burdens and barriers. As we saw, Honoria all at once was managing child welfare. She was managing housing, medical problems, summer school, all that had different rules of the game. She found that the school, as we show in the book, that the school blamed her for different issues. Her son was hardly talking in school, and they immediately focused on the home rather than focusing on school issues. And so we'd like to see our sociological models reflect this complexity empirically and theoretically. And if we do that, then we highlight more directly these obstacles which impede and create the reproduction of inequality. To be sure, people are activating cultural capital, social capital, economic capital, sometimes yielding to profits and sometimes not. And yet we need to understand these issues of effort and blocked access. And the concept of field is extremely valuable, as well as, and as this is difficult to do, to show empirically how people are navigating institutions and keep your eye on the rules of the game. But with this dual vision of the rules of the game in multiple institutions all at the same time, and people's efforts to activate their cultural knowledge, social, we believe that we can improve our models in sociology. Thank you very much. So I think we'll sit down here.
So let's open up to the floor and take a couple of questions. Would anyone like to begin? A comment, a reflection, question? Great, we've got two. Let's take two.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for that interesting presentation. I really enjoyed it, and I enjoyed learning about the book and your findings in it. One of the things that struck me as you discussed the various cases was this thread of various emotions, right? Being heartbroken, being rejected, just very difficult emotions throughout, and supposedly what's meant to be a very good thing that's happened to them. It made me think a little bit about the loss that occurs in upward mobility, for instance, that Heather Curl, Jennifer Morton, and so on have written about. I was just curious, and I guess I'm asking for the behind the scenes, when you were thinking about what you want to, what the biggest analytical takeaway from the work is, did emotions feature there at some point in the process when you're discussing it? And if so, how were you thinking about emotions? Was there some sort of theoretical takeaway about emotions that kind of occurred to you? And generally, if you could talk more about that.
Thanks for your question. Can you tell us who you are?
Oh, sure. I'm Alia Rao. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Methodology and also a sociologist.
Great. Let's take one more question and then we have time to give us.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Jonathan Inkley. I'm a research assistant at the Department of Sociology in the IAI. Really enjoyed it too, and I think the language of hurdles, knots, and reverberations is like super useful way of seeing a lot of the problems I see in like the grassroots housing organizing I do as well. So I think that's a really, really great contribution. My question is kind of methodological, and it's like when you were doing in these situations, there's probably a lot of times you found yourself able to be the person to untie some of these knots or to help with some of these hurdles. And I guess I was wondering, how did you deal with that in the situation of wanting to document these problematic processes that you yourself could quite easily have undone, maybe without realizing it, you know, if you're acting as translation in certain circumstances. So how did you deal with that problem of wanting to document the extent of the difficulties while also having this ethical compulsion probably to want to help these people?
Well, thank you both for those excellent questions. I'll take the methodological one first, and then we'll circle back to the emotions. Definitely a major challenge in doing this research was that is common to many research projects that are with more vulnerable populations, was when to intervene and how much. And so before starting the project, I decided, Annette and I talked extensively about this, and decided that I would never intervene when not asked. And this was largely because I thought it was very important to respect the family's preferences. And so if they didn't ask for my help, I thought it could seem maybe paternalistic or like I knew better. So I did not intervene in those instances. In other instances, I did do minor things to help, particularly when asked. For instance, in the whole knot where Malu was trying to coordinate all of the requirements for his daughter's early Head Start, she had to attend a medical appointment across town, and he wasn't sure how to get her there. So he asked me, would you call a cab and give them our address and the address? So I did do that, for instance. So there were little things woven throughout, but I really only intervened when asked. Honoria really wanted help with reading and writing. So every time I visited, I would print out exercise forms, and we would spend a chunk of time practicing the alphabet and letters. But it was, at other points, it's still hard when you see something going awry and somebody's not asking you to intervene and should you or not. It's a challenging situation. Yeah.
On the emotions, I mean, I think you can add too, but I was struck by how that they always often reference the refugee camp. Because there was tremendous, like the fact, I mean, people were extremely hungry all the time in the refugee camp. The rations were cut, and I mean, it was just very difficult. And so the fact that they came in here and they got food stamps and like, voila, none of the kids were hungry and asking for food, that was a very profound experience for them. And so I think that they were shocked by the level of inequality in the U.S. Some people thought the streets would be paved for gold. They literally thought it would be like heaven. And they, of course, became not just Americans. They were at the bottom of the inequality structure. They lived in very poor neighborhoods. They had dilapidated housing. All of the housing in Philadelphia practically has stairs. But you have a little bit of increased likelihood of being selected if you have a disability. So it was, you know, this issue of getting up and down the stairs and with the crutches and two 18-month-old twins and a four-year-old, it was challenging. But many of them, but people did from time to time say that they wish they hadn't come. You want to add to that, emotions?
Yeah, I think your point about upward mobility, like socioeconomic upward mobility, and then migrating to a pathway of potential kind of global upward mobility also, is really well put. I think that the families saw, as Annette mentioned, economic gains in sort of an absolute term from what they had in the refugee camp, but that came with great loss, right? Being across an ocean and many time zones away from family and friends, people they had deeply meaningful connections with, they felt a great sense of both responsibility but also loss around knowing that their loved ones were still facing hardships in those situations. And so that was like a very difficult emotional piece. This also came out, Joseph's father died and he wasn't able to say bye or to attend the funeral. And so that feeling of this sort of lost closeness in your social relationships as you change social location was a profound loss, I think, for the families. Yeah.
Something that struck me in one of the narratives that you gave is this side-by-side quality of economic uplift but cultural relegation. Mm-hmm. So you get the food stamp, but someone can come and take your kids. Mm-hmm. And how one navigates the complexities of that. You know, you might be relatively safe, but you're profoundly unsafe in other ways.
Exactly. In fact, a neighbor, Mala Mala, lived in the same building as Honoria, though from a different ethnic group. And when her kids were taken away because of the cold apartment, they started using more heat. But then they didn't realize the cost of it, and they got a huge heat bill of several hundred dollars. And then that triggered a whole set of issues as well.
Mike.
Thank you. Mike Savage, Sociology Department. Thank you so much. Really rich, interesting talk. I was reflecting, you know, what would it be like to do some study in the UK? I don't even know, but you know, there's so much anti-refugee sentiment whipped up in the UK. And it would be difficult to imagine, you know, refugees not feeling that, you know, as they go out there everyday interactions and media, looking at the media and things. It didn't seem to come out very much from what you were saying. That perhaps it was there, the sense of, you know, are we really welcome, or is this, are we sort of here because that's one of the difficult things, if there's anything to share on that.
Yeah, that's a great question. In the US, of course, there's also a huge anti-immigrant, anti-refugee sentiment. A lot of the research took place under the Trump administration and kind of in the wake of some of the travel bans around immigrants from certain countries, including many that other groups of refugees came from. And so this sentiment, I think, was there in the broader space, and certainly I think that many of the families we talked to were Christian, and so I think a lot of the sentiment was tied to anti-Islamic countries, particularly under the Muslim ban. So much of the kind of backlash was targeted towards those populations. So there was somewhat of an unevenness. But even with that, Philadelphia was sort of an interesting case because it is by policy a welcoming city, like a sanctuary. So the mayor was literally quoted in articles saying, we are a welcoming city, we want immigrants, we want refugees. And so I think in some ways we were interested to see that even in locations that were on paper welcoming, these populations are facing a lot of hurdles that maybe aren't directly targeted explicitly at being an immigrant or a refugee, but are creating problems for them anyways.
Hi, I'm Inna. I'm a PhD student at the Geography and Environment Department. And I have two questions. One is, because you were talking about you, I was wondering like whether you found anything related with social capital or cultural capital, because in that we see here in London, like especially in, from the Bangladeshi community, where this becomes a thing, like it becomes a field really, like how to deal, navigate with this situation, and also a cultural capital where the community help each other, but many services also are created, like people who have lived through it become service providers for others. So that we see here, like whether something like that is there. And the second one is somewhat, I don't know if you'll find it relevant, it's from my own discipline. So here we are seeing refugees like changing space, like coming from one country to the other and then facing these difficulties. But there are other contexts where you don't change the space, but the rules of the game changes. So you live in a forest, suddenly it becomes a reserved forest. It's a monument or a wildlife sanctuary, national park. And the ways of living is not relevant anymore. You have to learn all these processes to be able to remain there. So whether you see like what you have seen as patterns and processes that you've seen, like do you see relevance of that in those conditions as well?
One thing that we saw that was really interesting, Annette was mentioning the volunteers who were predominantly white upper middle class and did not have experiences of being in poverty in the US. And so when they were helping, volunteering with these families, they spoke about how in many ways they were learning about the US themselves. And so they were struck by how unequal and different systems are for people in poverty than middle class, upper middle class people in the US. So they faced, right, food stamps and how sort of just insane all of the different complicated rules are about how to use the food stamp. And they were just completely shocked, right? And they were native born Americans who knew the system in theory, right? But they found out quickly that this was a different system. And so in many ways, they were newcomers themselves and learned about their own country through that experience. So that was more of like, you know, happening at the same time, but different cultural rules, even in the same geographical area. Then thinking about social capital, for instance, and how does it matter? One thing that I think was really interesting is that the Congolese were a pretty new resettlement group. So many of the families were all learning this all at the same time. So there wasn't this sort of like built up social knowledge passed between Congolese to other Congolese, right? With the same extensive maybe know-how about how food assistance works or welfare or how to navigate hospital situations. So that was in some ways meant that these families were particularly, had an extremely institutional experience where caseworkers really were a key kind of form of social capital for them. And so you do see over time sort of those relationships and knowledge being built up, but it was sort of slowly building.
I mean, I think you could also see that sometimes opportunities for social capital, say at the workplace, were thwarted because of discrimination. In the interviews especially, people talked about people saying, you know, hostile things about being Africans especially. Not having the same language skills. Joseph wanted to get promoted, but he didn't speak English and he needed to speak Spanish to get promoted. And so you'll see that, and Joseph and Georgette were in a very high cost of living neighborhood that the church families have put him in. But they moved partly through Congolese social ties to a cheaper area where they got jobs. But they went to a much worse school system. So they went to one of the best schools in America at first, and they went to one of the worst schools in America when they moved. And so there were many, though they were picked up by another religious group, that there was one incident where Georgette got fired on a temporary contract, and Joseph said, oh, you can just apply again. And the volunteer said, no, she'll never get a job. But he was right. She did get a job, and she could apply again. So sometimes he had insider knowledge that the team didn't have.
Oh, thank you for this amazing presentation.
I think they want you to wait for the microphone.
I'm a visiting PhD student in the Department of Sociology. I really enjoyed the presentation. My question is, in the follow-up interviews that you conducted 5 years after their resettlement, did you find any radical changes in their narratives, in their experience of hurdles and knots? I mean, did they become more relaxed about these? Everything seemed like more heaven-like? Or the hurdles and the knots just continued but in different forms? Thank you.
Could I add to that question? Mm-hmm. I'm interested in how you conceptualize the family here. I think it's very clear how you conceptualize the operation of the institution. And I'm thinking, we had a conversation earlier, so I did a little bit of research on migrants from the DRC who came to South Africa. And there was no transition of a refugee camp. So it's a one-way line down, and it's largely made by individuals. So people come in very fragmented forms without family, mm-hmm. and they have to navigate the resource accumulation as an individual. To what extent was the family a structure for the acquisition of capital, the depletion of capital, a means of untying the knot? I'm just curious what that unit of analysis does mm-hmm. to the understanding.
So I'll start first with the question about changes in obstacles. And so certainly over time, the obstacles, families learned the rules of the game, right? And so some things that were hard at first became easier. But the families found that as they sort of advanced in the day-to-day life and sort of becoming set up in the US, the kinds of institutional navigational processes they were having became also more complicated. So for example, Elaine and Vanna's son made it to college. He had a lot of help from institutional insiders, a teacher who took interest in him, who tutored him. He had went through a long application process. She helped him write essays. He did the SATs, all of these kind of really key institutional steps. He got to college. He learned how to be a college student. He went to office hours. He asked questions. He studied. He went, at first he started and was getting C's, and then he worked his way up to getting A's. But all of this was almost derailed by one form that was missing one signature for his financial aid. And so this sort of financial aid is a very complicated process, and it depended on his parents' tax returns, and there was an issue with a tax document. So you can see how some of applying for college then seemed like an easy situation compared to this very complicated financial paperwork that crossed institutions, and that one signature almost derailed his entire, all the progress he had made thus far. So what we saw was really over time, these obstacles continued to persist. They just changed a little bit in the exact nature and sort of the resource that was on the line.
I mean, all the families attended church, and through that, as married couples, they met different people. A lot of research has shown that children act as cultural brokers, and that was clearly the case here. When one family bought a house and then the tenant wouldn't pay rent, it was the son who went to the police, and the police told them about eviction court, and then the son taught his father how to do that. So you did see children helping. But also, one of the families had a kid who needed became diabetic, and a CPS case was opened when he and the parents understood it because they weren't there at night. It was unclear why it happened, but then it was the school who told the CPS people that they're a very nice family, you know, and I think so. Then the other social capital ties helped the family resolve.
Yeah, so I think in some ways the family could be a source of support, right? You pool people and their abilities and their skills and their assistance to all help each other kind of overcome these obstacles. But at the same time, I think it also multiplied the number of institutional interactions that any one family had, right? It wasn't just dealing with your own medical treatment or going to work for you as an individual. It was also syncing that up with institutional interactions for your children, right? So Elaine worked at a bread factory at night because somebody had to be at home during the day with the kids. So you see they were syncing up these institutional interactions and decisions to accommodate the whole family.
Hi, I'm Elliot. I'm second year undergraduate from Sociology Department, and thank you for your great presentation. So I have two questions. The first one is, I'm curious about, so does these institutions and their bureaucratic process are very easy for the middle class in...
Can't quite hear you. Say it a little louder, please.
So like, does this institutions and their bureaucratic process are very easier for middle class in US? Maybe like there is something you find from the interview with these volunteers, because I feel like all of this bureaucratic process is very annoying for like everyone. So like, if it is annoying for everyone, why does it like that? Because I feel like it's supposed to make people's life easier, right? So this is my first question. And the second question is, have you found out the reason, like why Congolese is the largest proportion of resettled migrants in US?
So why the DRC, why are they the largest? And what's the logic behind institutional complexity that actually doesn't work for anyone?
So first to kind of just go to the question about why Congolese, this was surprising to us too. I had, for a separate project, done interviews with aid workers in East Africa, and they talked about the selection of this group, like kind of before it started coming. And so aid workers discussed that this was related in part to sort of the post-war on terror policies in the US, which made it so that if you came from a predominantly Muslim country that had any kind of group that the US considered a terrorist group, particularly if they were involved in the conflict there, there was an additional security clearance process for all resettled refugees, which meant it took longer to process their case. So aid workers were really short on time. And if the process took too long, the quota or spots for resettlement just disappeared. They couldn't roll over to the next year. So aid workers moved priority categories to these sort of fast cases or clean cases. And Congolese were considered to be a faster population to process. Additionally, they're predominantly Christian. They didn't have some of those background checks. And it was a population that was deemed a clear case of need, who had vulnerability and fit under all of the sort of qualifications for that status. So they moved it to priority category.
I mean, I guess there's been a literature on street level bureaucrats by Lipsky, and how I think especially with welfare agencies, we know that although they're allegedly trying to help people, in fact, they spend a lot of time trying to prohibit services. So it's hard. I mean, middle class people have these complexities too. over health insurance in the US, especially life insurance, car accidents, all kinds of things have created these knots in everybody's lives. But people approach them with different levels of expertise. And so I'm always noticing how people will, like if I have a problem in life, I'll find a professional who's an insight expert, a doctor, a lawyer, whatever, in my professionally rich networks. And so people might have the same problems, but they don't have the same access to informal knowledge about how to navigate the situation. I mean, I've been an immigrant here. I have a visa because of the Leverhulme, and I've made a million mistakes here. So one mistake I made is I applied, I needed an NHS number because of LSE told me I needed it. So, you know, I read a website, I have a PhD, you think I'd figure this out. I applied for a card, and I never heard back, you know. And then I got a letter from NHS saying, LSE saying, you need a number. And it turned out I had never applied for a number. I hadn't applied for an NHS number, I applied for a card. And those they're not the same systems, you know. And so there's all this informal knowledge that you just don't understand.
We've got a question online, so I might see if I can access it. In the meantime.
Is there another question in the room in the meantime?
Also,
I have a little question about the methodology. You said that you did observations from 9 to 18 months. So I assume that with some of the families you did shorter ethnographic observations and with some longer. So how did you make those decisions and the frequency of your visits? How did you arrange for those visits? Thank you.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I sort of mentioned in passing that for some families it was 9 months of ethnography and others 18. This was actually not a choice that I made. It was rather the fact that two of the families moved to Iowa, which was across the country. They had friends and family there, and so they actually, it was in the wake of the really high electricity bill. They deemed life in Philadelphia too expensive, and so they moved across the country. We stayed in touch by phone, and kind of I got updates, but of course I couldn't visit their house all the time. And so for the other families, I continued on. I will say that I did not visit all families completely equally. One challenge is your families are letting you into their lives. And so you have to go based on sort of their schedule and availability. Elaine and Vanna, there was almost no one home for huge chunks of time. Vanna was gone all day, and then Elaine was asleep for a lot of the day, and then Elaine went and worked the night shift, and Vanna didn't come home from work until very late. She commuted from, like, it was like a 2-hour drive. So it was very difficult to catch them when they were home because they just weren't home that often. So I spent less time in person at their home, for instance. Yeah. But then we tried to do longer interviews and make sure that we still got enough of that kind of in-depth data.
So you kind of spent more time just commuting with them to the institutions and kind of?
Yeah, and just, right. And so I think it's sort of one of those things where it's like you meet families where they are. And so it's sort of interesting that you kind of need the family to be home or around or have somebody who you can do observations with.
So shall I read out the question from
online?
So we've got a question from Sasha Aiken. Sorry if I pronounced that incorrectly, Sasha. So, hiya, loving the book so far. My PhD research is focused on the work that refugees do to navigate the institution of housing, as this intersects with all the other institutions they have to navigate on a day-to-day basis. Your book is pretty inspiring for learning how to do this effectively. I'm interested in how you avoided falling into the trap of simply regurgitating the bureaucratic language and terminology of the institutions, their processes, and the people who work within them when communicating with your participants. reflecting critically on the organization of these institutions. Thank you, Sasha.
Thank you for your interest and your work. I can't wait to read it. Yeah, I think it's a great question. How, if I'm understanding the question correctly, right, you're doing research with people in these different bureaucratic organizations and with the families themselves, and how do you decide how to talk about things to the family? I think in this case, and we included kind of a note in our book on this, we tried to follow the lead of the families and however they talked about things. So I did most of the research with the families in Swahili, so also there was a language. We were using Swahili, so that immediately changed what language and words we were using. But often, so we choose, for instance, to talk about food assistance or food stamps instead of SNAP, because that's what the families used. And we chose to, and that's what we did in the field as well. And so in general, also in terms of doing interviews, we kept questions quite broad. And this gave the families room to answer using the terms that they chose, and to choose what they felt was important. And then we would probe within that question to learn more, right?
I think also, which has been sort of a mantra in my career, is we really wanted the book to be clearly written, and we really, you know, we worked, other people will judge that, but we worked hard at that. So we didn't want to lighten it down. So in the end, all discussion of Borgia and Fields is in a very short appendix, as I did in Unable Childhoods too. So it was clearly theoretically informed, but we tried to, and similarly, there was a ton of data with interviews with the aid workers and the other refugees. We agonized about it. We created these large tables where, do you want to show them the slide on the tab? Yeah. And you know, we were just determined, but then there was just too many pages. It was too detailed. It bogged it down. So we had to let it go. So we focused on the voices and the experiences of these families and to try to evoke their experiences. I mean, one thing we noticed was that people learned more about race because through the George Floyd situation was Brown and Blair did the, so this is an example of the rules of the game. This is not making it into the book.
Yeah, so we had extensive charts for every institution with every institutional process using kind of more the language of the institution and what their rules were and what the procedures were and what the required documentation was. But it was just simply too long. There was no way we could put this in the, our editor wouldn't.
And it was boring and technical.
Yeah.
And we were trying, you know, it just was out. But it was hard to have done. Like in any writing, you write all this stuff and you have to cut it. You know, it's just the way it goes. Well, Blair, do you want to talk to them about race a little bit and how they talked about George Floyd? And
that would maybe take us to the end.
Okay, good.
So one thing that I think was Annette mentioned, and this is kind of coming from also the title of our book, the families really, you know, thought that coming to the U.S. was going to be sort of like the promised land, like, and the title comes from a quote from one of our respondents who said, when we came to the U.S., we thought it would be like going to heaven. And so instead they find inequality, and that was extremely shocking to our respondents. They were not expecting that. And so that was not only by class, but certainly by race as well. And so the families, it was really interesting. I would ask them, have you faced racial discrimination? And they would say no. And sort of as a white American, I'm thinking, oh, think probably you have, right? But who am I to say this? And so one thing, that was something we were particularly interested in and sort of wondered, maybe the families are not reporting it to me because I'm white and American and they didn't feel comfortable. But we were really interested that they had pretty similar reports to our Kenyan aid workers who were phenotypically Black. Many of them were, they were undergrads, they were very involved in racial justice issues in the US as well. And so what we found was that for many of the families, it was kind of the first time they really thought of themselves as Black or realized that other people saw them as Black. And so we have many quotes where people talk about how their identity in the Congo was really based on ethnic affiliation. I'm Bembe. I'm Banyamulenge. Like these were like ethnic groups that had deep meaning for their identity and were not based on race. And so they talked a lot about how everyone was Black. So there was nothing about white and Black for them. And so it was only in the US that they realized that other people were identifying them as Black, and this was very surprising to them. And when the police murder of George Floyd happened in the US, this was kind of a moment of acute racialization for these families. And so in particular, they found the salience of police and state violence mapped onto their understanding of ethnic conflict and particularly by state actors and soldiers and police in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And so this was like a huge reckoning for a lot of the families in terms of understanding racial inequality in the US, but also where they were being placed within it.
Fascinating. Thank you so much for your fantastic talk and for all this careful, substantial research. Please join me in congratulating.